Good afternoon and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly radio connection to bicycles and cycling, as well as fitness and other related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is a radio show produced by cyclists for cyclists. And now here's your host, the Outspoken Cyclist herself, Diane Lees.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Lees, along with Greg Priddy.
Hi, Diane. How are you?
Fancy seeing you here again. I'm fine.
Yeah, we seem to manage to get ourselves here about this time every week.
Yeah, well, that, and we had to come in a couple of times this week to get one of the interviews we'll share with you this evening. It's very special.
Yes, it is.
Yes, and we got it.
Finally, yeah.
Yes, and it actually came out pretty well, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't mention our social media stuff a lot. But we're so close to this milestone that if you are inclined to hit that little like button and bring us to 800 this week, I would be so happy. I don't think many of our listeners are big Facebook fans, but I know we have more than 800 listeners worldwide. We know that for a fact. So anyway.
Here's to arbitrary milestones.
Thanks. Yeah, well, I mean, it's pretty dang arbitrary. Anyway, you have been ruminating on your pro-cycling thoughts. Would you like to share them?
Well, I'm always pro-cycling, but I'm not always pro-cycycling.
Oh,
pro-professional
thoughts. Yes.
I did give a lot of thought to it this week after we had a conversation about the tour and, you know, many things like that. And I'll see if I can reconstruct my thoughts coherently here.
Okay.
Would you say that there has always been cheating of some sort to some degree in professional bike racing?
Yes.
And as time has progressed, that cheating started to take the form of doping?
Yes.
And are you really of the opinion that they're ever going to be able to eliminate
cheating
as in the form of doping from professional bike racing?
I don't know. I don't actually have a fully formed opinion because I think things evolve and cheating takes different forms. Doping evidently takes different forms. It used to be marijuana.
Yeah.
A lot of that. And speed.
Yes. Amphetamines were the first.
Well,
yeah.
No, marijuana was before amphetamines.
I'm not sure how that would enhance your performance, but anyway.
Well, it didn't hurt going up that hill. Well, I don't know where that
perhaps.
Mountain. But
it seems to me like as soon as money is involved, or even in some cases when money isn't involved, but there are stakes high enough to warrant getting an advantage. And no matter what, you're talking about sport, you're talking about business. Look
right.
at our world financial systems and all the outright cheating that's
right.
gone on there. As soon as there's money involved, there will be cheating.
Power and greed.
Yep. So I've kind of come over the last few weeks to just reconcile myself with the fact that I think I'm not as optimistic as you. I think there will always be doping in cycling. I just think it's a fact of life. I don't think they're ever going to get rid of it.
Okay.
We thought we've gotten rid of it several times over the last, you know, 20, 30 years, and it just keeps
rearing its
coming
ugly head.
Back. Yeah.
Okay.
Here's where I think professional cycling and the governing bodies sort of missed the boat. Look at the other sports, particularly professional baseball, professional football.
Okay.
Some of those. There's doping in those sports. They're
yes.
using steroids, HGH. They catch those players. They suspend them. They give them the sanction or whatever. But they don't seem to obsess about it.
Well, that is true.
They sort of have accepted that it's a fact of life, that it's going to happen, and they're going to find them and fine them and suspend them and whatnot.
And then they move on.
They move on, and they don't let it become the focal point. And the other thing, and I know this is a difference between a team sport and an individual sport, but they don't go back and rewrite the results when they find someone who has cheated. We don't go and reassign the winner of the World Series or the Super Bowl because a certain number of people on the winning team were found to be abusing performance-enhancing drugs.
Right? That's a good point.
I don't know why cycling can't adopt a more pragmatic attitude
Too
like that.
Too many governing bodies. You have so many people involved. It's worldwide. Remember now,
it
you're
is.
Looking at sports in the U.S., you're looking at sports in the U.S. You're looking at baseball, football, basketball.
Yeah. What about soccer, though?
Well,
soccer's global.
Yeah, and I don't know much. I have to admit, I don't know a lot about soccer.
Yeah, well, you have FIFA, which is kind of the governing body of soccer. So maybe you're right. It is the proliferation of people with their hands
fingers
on the
fingers in the pie.
So I've come to the conclusion that I do like professional cycling. I've actually watched a couple of tour stages this year.
They're exciting.
They have been, and I have been excited about them. And I realized that it's not the race itself that turns me off. It's not the doping that turns me off. It's cycling's reaction to doping.
Okay.
I don't like having to wait 12 months to find out who the winner of last year's tour was. And by the same token, just saying, well, we're going to throw the first guy off the podium and move everybody up one place is completely realistic, because if we could have gotten in our Wayback Machine and discovered that Alberto Contador was doping and we kicked him out of the tour, Andy Schleck may or may not have won the tour that year.
Right.
Because
we don't know that for
because
sure.
The race would have unfolded differently without Alberto Contador in it. So it is, I think, in my mind, ludicrous just to say, oh, well, kick this guy out, everybody moves up a place, and we go on. It's like, if you find somebody after the fact, then don't change the results. Put an asterisk after his name and move on.
Really?
Yeah.
I like that. Who do you think you can convince of this? Besides
nobody.
Someone
not sitting across the table from me? Probably nobody.
Oh, I'm not so sure. I think that there needs – so maybe the fans –
yeah.
Are tired of it and so need to have a voice in it. Right now it's the UCI, it's the people with the tour, it's the managers of the teams. It's very interesting.
Right. Well, you have the various USADA, WADA, UCI, ASO, all these alphabet soup of acronyms that would have to come together. And first of all.
Well, there's your big problem right there, trying to get them all to come together.
Well, the first problem is that. I still think that they think that they're going to eliminate doping from cycling. They're living in this pipe dream that if we just test enough and test hard enough and we that someday it's going to be clean. Well, it's not going to be clean. So
as long as there's money and other things like it involved. And we have the same problem with the war on drugs in the United States. There's a perfect
kinda
parallel
like
there.
Yeah.
Parallel.
And I think that, and my last thought is that there should be some sort of a moratorium on going back after people retire. Because, again, going back to the baseball and the football, we're not digging up Babe Ruth's body
to find out
what he might have been on when he hit all those home runs. We're not testing people who've been retired for 5 years from the sport and then trying to go back and strip them of their accomplishments. It's like when a cyclist retires, too bad. If they got away with it, they got away with it. Don't go back and try and rewrite history or trying to tell, it's like focus on what's here and now, and which sort of leads us back around to the Lance Armstrong thing. I'm convinced in my mind that he cheated. That's just my opinion.
I think it's a moot point now. Yeah, exactly.
He's gone. He's not a professional cyclist anymore. If you want to test him now, when in his triathlon days and for Ironman
then
competitions,
it's a different competition.
Fine. If he's still competing in competitions that are subject to testing, test him now and let the consequences there fall. But
don't go back 10 years.
Thaw out that freezer full of urine and blood and put it in a biohazard lab.
Flush it.
That's right. Flush it. I do think that professional cycling is exciting, can be exciting, but not as it's currently being administered. And I think that's too bad.
All right.
Anyway.
So our show tonight actually harkens back to 1986 in the tour.
Mm-hmm.
And so it will be interesting to hear what our guest will say. This is, of course, the end of the 99th Tour de France this year. And we will be speaking with Richard Moore, who is the author of Slaying the Badger, Greg LeMond, Bernard Hinault, and the Greatest Tour de France.
Hmm.
The book is a series of interviews, including one each with LeMond and Hinault. It's fascinating from the first page. It's beautifully written. And Mr. Moore is in the press room of the Tour de France when we catch up with him. So Very appropriate. We'll bring it around to that. We're also going to speak with Don Ferris. Don is the proprietor of Anvil Bike Works. Don is also a perfectionist, but he'll tell you maybe probably something different. You'll be able to see in his tools, in his frame fixtures, in the physical plant into which he just moved it to Golden, Colorado last month. It looks like you can eat off the floors. And Don is supposed to be just a delightful guy, and we'll find out about that. I don't know if we're going to get any news in. I think we just did all the news that was fit to do.
I think I sucked up all the news time.
You sucked up our news time.
I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I'm glad you're finally thinking that bike racing's exciting, because I think when our velodrome opens, you're going to think that a lot. So let's sit back and welcome Richard Moore, author of Slaying the Badger, to The Outspoken Cyclist. Richard, thanks for joining us this evening.
Pleasure.
Yes, it's exciting to talk to you while you're at the tour. I understand there's pea soup today out there instead of air.
Yeah, there is. Yes, it was a beautiful, clear day in the Pyrenees, but the cloud has come down today, and it's pretty thick. No rain, but it's pretty murky out there.
Well, this obviously is not your first tour. We're going to talk about your book, Slaying the Badger, Greg LeMond, Bernard Hinault, and the Greatest Tour de France. So you obviously fell in love with cycling and cyclists around the age of 11 when you watched Robert Millar win a stage in the Tour. So you kind of grew up to write the book about him.
That's right. And the first Robert Millar's first stage win was in the town that I'm in now, actually, Luchon, in 1983. He won the stage here, which was identical to yesterday's stage in the Pyrenees. And it was the following year where, again in the Pyrenees, he won a second stage, and that was the first time he flashed across my radar, really. I watched the highlight show with my dad and developed a bit of an interest. My dad was interested anyway, so I developed a bit of an interest in Robert Millar, especially in the Tour de France. And then in 86, the race was broadcast every day for the first time in the UK, and that was the Hinault Le Monde Tour de France, obviously, and the one that my new book is about.
So the book is really a series of interviews.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to... The race was intriguing at the time because there was this drama going on between Hinault and Le Monde, who were on the same team but were the strongest two riders in the race. And the drama had really begun the previous year in 85 when Hinault struggled a bit in the final week with injuries and illness. He'd crashed heavily at St. Etienne. He had bronchitis. He had a broken nose. And in that final week in 85, Le Monde emerged as a slightly stronger rider, I think. And there was one stage where he got clear with Stephen Roach and was told to wait for Hinault. And Le Monde really felt that he'd sacrificed his chance to win the Tour in order to help Hinault, which was what he'd been hired to the team Lavie-Clair to do. But during the Tour, during that final week, Hinault allegedly made a promise to Le Monde that he would help him the following year in 86, which was also Hinault's final year. But when the 86 Tour came around, it was clear from the way that Hinault rode that he wasn't helping Le Monde and that he wasn't honouring his promise. And so there was this fascinating tussle between them. A lot of it remained, a lot of it was not really known about the time, because obviously the team was trying to keep a lid on the tension between the pair. But Le Monde was this very open and honest guy. He couldn't really help himself, and you could see in interviews that he was really struggling under the strain of his battle with Hinault, with his teammate. And that made the race really fascinating, and also the nature of the two riders. They were complete opposites in virtually every way, in the way that they rode and their personalities. You know, Hinault was rough and, you know, known as the Badger. He was tough and surly and aggressive. And Le Monde was open and friendly and very accessible and very vulnerable, really. So it was a fascinating tussle between them.
Well, you do portray Bernard Hinault as a spare man even today. You know, no fancy lifestyle, lives on his farm, very sort of still the Badger.
Still the Badger, yeah. He's still got that snarl. You see it occasionally. He's in his mid-50s now, but he's very... very recognizably the Badger. He's a simple man. I don't mean that in an unkind way. He's very emphatic. Like everything with Hinault is black or white. You know, he's not. I don't think he's somebody who's given to a lot of reflection or thought. And whereas Le Monde is really always thinking, always his mind is always working, and they're just very, very different personalities.
Well, early in the book, you mentioned something called the Professional Writers Trade Union, and that led a writer's strike. Can you tell us a little bit about that union, because that isn't in place today, as far as I know.
No, I mean, it's funny. I think this harks back to cycling's roots. You know, it was very much a working class sport where the riders were drawn from factories and farms and so on, as indeed Eno was. And there was it's quite interesting because in newer cycling countries such as the US and the UK, it's very much a middle class sport, whereas in its heartland it was a working class sport. And the riders were, you know, going back to the days of Henri de Grange, the early tours were workers of the pedal. You know, that was what they were known as. They weren't fancy professional sportsmen. They were always professional, of course, but they were seen as tradesmen rather than you know, professional stars, I suppose. In 78, that was a year where there were quite a few split stages, like two stages in a day. And there was one day in particular where the stage began at 8 o'clock. The first stage began at 8 o'clock in the morning and finished in Valence. And then it would start again from there an hour and a half later and with another stage, I think to Toulouse, from memory. Again, it was coming up from the Pyrenees in the area that I'm in now. And for the riders, it was just too much. Most of them had got to their hotels at past midnight the previous night. And that morning, Eno led a strike. The riders were unhappy, and Eno was the guy. He wasn't in the yellow jersey at the time. He was actually French national champion. So he was in the French champion's jersey, which gave him some authority, some standing. And he decided he was going to lead the strike. So they rode slow all stage, and then they stopped before the line. And they were very, you know, this was an unpopular move. That they were being booed and having tomatoes thrown at them by the crowd in Valence. And the mayor was especially angry. But Eno stood up to all that, and stood up to the mayor and stood up to the tour organizers. And I actually did succeed, I think, in changing the conditions of labor a little bit. You know, the tour has progressively since then become a little bit easier. I mean, I say that it's all relative, but you don't get split stages anymore, and you get two rest days now. Sometimes back then there were no rest days. So it's, things have changed a little bit, and there's definitely more, the riders have more power now as they've earned more money, which in fact, linking again to the story, Le Monde had an awful lot to do, a lot of influence in raising riders' salaries. He brought some American free market values to the sport. And so the two of those riders, I mean, Le Monde and Eno, both very, very influential in quite different ways. Eno as a kind of trade union leader and Le Monde as the guy who raised the bar as far as salaries were concerned.
I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners we're speaking with Richard Moore. He's in France at the Tour de France in the press room, and he's talking to us about his new book, Slaying the Badger, Greg LeMond, Bernard Hinault, and the Greatest Tour de France. So do you think today that a riders' union would have made any difference in all of the controversy we're seeing, not just in the Tour, but in professional cycling in general?
I don't know. I mean, it's still a sport with there's maybe not the same organization, but there's still, we saw the other day when there were tacks on the road and there was a ghost law organized by Bradley Wiggins when Cadell Evans was held up and he was a few minutes behind. And there's still a sense that they are a collective, and that the man, you know, at the tour, the guy in the yellow jersey is the person that calls the shots. We saw it a few years ago as well on the stage into Spa when the conditions were very dangerous, and Fabian Cancellara ordered a truce, a ceasefire. They still, you know, because of the nature of the sport, they do look out for each other. And if there are things that are making their lives and their jobs more dangerous, then they will take action, whether it be road furniture. In terms of doping, which is obviously the biggest controversy, I'm not sure there. I mean, there's still a riders association. I think Gianni Bugno is the head of that. They've not been very effective on the subject of doping.
Yeah.
It's still, there are one or two exceptions to the rule, but there are still a lot of riders who they don't really speak very coherently on the subject.
Yeah, it's sort of sad because every time it comes up, it, you know, when you have such an exciting tour as we've had this year, it comes up and it sort of, you know, takes the air out of it. Yeah, it makes.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, it's necessary as well. I think given the history of the sport, you can't pretend that it's not been a part of it, and I think that would be dangerous to not. And Bradley Wiggins has found himself, you know, faced with questions about doping and doping suspicion purely because he's the rider in the yellow jersey. It's not personal. It's but when you lead the race, you're not just the wearer of the yellow jersey. You become the yellow jersey, and that gives you a responsibility, I think, to speak very clearly and to reassure people, because I think people need to believe in the leader and the winner of the tour, and that's the nature of the sport now, sadly.
Yeah, and I think that was put very well. That makes it very easy to understand. So getting back to your book for a second, these interviews, you interviewed Hinault's early trainer, and I don't know if I'm going to say his name correctly, Guimard?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, Cyril Guimard. Yeah.
Yeah. It seemed like real character. A real character.
He is one of the great characters in the sport. I mean, he was a top rider himself in the 70s, a rival to Eddie Merckx. More of a sprinter than Merckx, and won a lot of stages of the tour. And then he became a director sportif, retired quite early, became director of Hinault's team in 77. But he is a real character. I mean, he is one of the most successful directors ever in the sport. He also discovered Le Monde and gave him his break in Europe. So he had a strong link with both the main characters in this book.
Well, there are several fabulous interviews in this book, and the book itself is just fascinating. How long did it take you to write it?
Spent about a year. Well, actually, a little bit more than a year, probably about 18 months doing the interviews and writing it up. But that was about the process, and it involved a bit of travel, obviously, over to the States to see Greg LeMond and to Brittany to see Hinault, and Switzerland to see Paul Coakley. So a little bit of travel involved in it as well.
Did you have fun over here?
Yes, I did. I did. I my brother lives in Washington, D.C., so I stayed with him and then flew up to Minneapolis and just stayed a night there and visited Le Monde. And they were very hospitable, but gave me my dinner and they were very friendly. It was very enjoyable, and it was fascinating to sit and talk to Le Monde for several hours about this race. I thought we could have talked for much longer, actually.
Well, it seems like all of these riders have, or both of these riders have their view of it. You know, it's personal. It's from your own perspective, but it's interesting what Le Monde remembers and what Hinault remembers, and sort of what the other characters remember. I think it's a very interesting story. So, you think that this was the greatest race of them all. Can you kind of sum up why that was or is?
Yeah, I think it's the intrigue, but also for me, the personalities. I think Hinault is one of the great personalities, not just in cycling, but in any sport. You know, he was a ferocious warrior, and it was trying to understand where that came from was, for me, very interesting. And I don't know if Hinault himself even really knows where that comes from. Le Monde was this far more fragile character, hugely, hugely talented. And so that's what made it so fascinating for me. And also because they were on the same team, there was an awful lot that went unsaid. And I think that the beauty of cycling as a sport to write about is that, you know, every day on the tour there are 180-odd riders. Each of those riders has their own story at the end of the day. And so much happens that we don't see as viewers. And even people in the race, like Andy Hampson is one of my interviewees, he contacted me after the book came out and said that there was a lot of things in the book that he had never known. And yet he was there. He was a participant. And that for me is what is so interesting. You know, there was even a story that Hampson told me about the stage to Super Bagnères, where he attacked and he was clear. And the trainer, Paul Coakley, came up to him and told him he could go on and win the tour. And I told Le Monde that story, and he'd never heard that. So, you know, there was so much going on. And it still is the case. It's the nature of cycling that, because it's not a simple sport that takes place in front of the cameras like a tennis match or a football match where everything is visible and you can see the action happening. In cycling, so much goes unseen, and the truth sometimes only emerges years and years later. So it's a really rich, rich topic. I mean, as far as the 86 Tour being the best ever tour, that's an entirely subjective call by me.
sure.
Partly because you know, I was 13 when I watched it, so it was at a very impressionable age. And but I do think that when you discuss with other possible candidates, people talk about 1989 and the Le Mans Fignon Tour. That was a very close tour. It was a very close battle between them. For me, it lacked the behind-the-scenes drama that was obviously going on in the La Vie Claire team between Eno and Le Mans, and the way the team became divided between the two riders. Yeah, for me, it had all the ingredients that you need for a great tour, and I stick by my selection.
And you are welcome to have that. Well, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule in the press room at the tour. I think the book is awesome, and I hope it is very successful. I've already heard from a few people who said, oh, I read it. I love it. And so I liked it a lot, and I highly recommend it. So, Richard, have a great rest of the tour. It's going to be over soon.
Thanks,
Diane. And yeah. We'll talk again someday, I hope.
Yeah, I hope so. Thanks very much, Diane.
All right. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Richard Moore joined us from France, where he's covering the tour.
Yes, he is.
Lucky guy.
Yeah.
Wow, it must have been neat to have access to Bernard Eno and Greg LeMond to write that book.
Well, you need to read this book. It is really interesting, and it is also kind of thrilling to go back to 1986 when, you know, everybody in cycling's hero was Greg LeMond in those days.
Yeah.
But Zibadjur was a very, very strong figure.
Tough guy.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. He still comes out at the podium presentations, I think, on the tour. I've seen him on TV.
In Paris?
Well, in all along the tour route, I see him, you know, shaking the winner's hand and being part of it. Yeah.
I think it's nice. Awesome.
Well, we've got time for a short bit of news here.
Okay. So I'm going to do this one quickly, although it could be longer. We're wrapping up the tour, so we're heading for the Olympics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to know what was happening in cycling at the 2012 Olympics. And there will be 5 different venues. There will be 18 events and 500 athletes.
Wow.
Yeah. So there are a couple of events that are no more. They've taken the Madison out of track, and the team sprint, the team pursuit, and Kieran will be added to the women's programs this year.
Oh, okay.
And then there's an Omnium. Aha! What is an Omnium, you might ask? It's a multiple race event in track cycling. Historically, the Omnium has had a variety of formats. Currently for 2012, the Omnium, as defined by the UCI, consists of the following 6 events. A flying lap against the clock. A points race, which consists of a 30-kilometer for elite men, 20-kilometer for elite women, 15-kilometer for junior men, and 10-kilometer for junior women. An elimination. I'm not sure exactly how that works. It's sort of a missing out, I think, that, you know, they keep the last person. And an individual pursuit, 4,000 meters for elite men, 3,000 meters for junior men and elite women, and 2,000 meters for junior women, a scratch race, and a time trial. Points are awarded in reverse order. The rider who finishes first in an event receives 1 point, second rider gets 2 points, and so on.
So low score wins.
Yeah, evidently.
And these are all on the track?
Yes. It was reintroduced into the World Championships as a 5-race format for men in 2007 and for women in 2009. It was changed in 2010 by the UCI to include the elimination race, and the distances of the events were lengthened to favor endurance cyclists.
Okay.
Isn't that cool?
I have to look around and see if there's going to be any TV coverage of cycling events at the Olympics.
There is supposed to be TV coverage by NBC Sports of almost all the cycling events this year.
Well, that would be
cool.
We'll
see. Yeah, it will be. Then the Paralympic Games are going to open in August, and Her Majesty the Queen will be opening the Paralympics.
Okay.
So I thought that was kind of cool. This is about Rails to Trails. RTC, Rails to Trails, visited Brunswick in June. So Brunswick is actually between Washington, D.C. and Cumberland, Maryland.
Oh,
it's one of the little towns along the C&O Canal towpath.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what's really cool, though, is in late August, the Smithsonian is bringing an exhibit to Brunswick and is expected to attract thousands of visitors. Part of the Smithsonian's Museums on Main Street series, the Journey series, examines how we and our ancestors came to America. This exhibition is a great reason to build a journey story of your own along the C&O Canal to the historical community of Brunswick. So they're going to have this exhibition, which I think is going to be really cool. And you can go to brunswickmainstreet.org to find out more about the exhibition in late August and maybe take the C&O Canal, you know, towpath and go on down there.
Okay.
All right.
All right, we've got to take a short break here.
Okay.
And when we come back, we're going to switch from racing to tool building. We'll talk with Don Ferris of Anvil Bike Works right after this on The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Whether you remember poodle skirts, mini skirts, or bell bottoms,
you're just the right age.
Whether you liked Ike or loved Lucy,
your help is needed.
Even if you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, or beyond, you can sign up to become an organ and tissue donor.
Think you're too old? Think again.
Any age is the right age to donate the gift of life.
Sign up today at organdonor.gov or call 1-866-99-DONATE.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Health Resources and Services Administration.
I'm Greg Priddy.
And I'm Diane Lees.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're going to move directly out to Golden, Colorado.
And we're going to speak with Don Ferris from Anvil Bike Works. Don, thanks for joining us on the show this evening.
Well, thank you, Diane. Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk about you, and we're going to talk about Anvil Bike Works. And the first thing I want to know is, you say professional tools for the professional builder. I want to know how you define a professional builder.
Well, I think a professional builder is anybody who builds frames for money from others. You know, not your kids, not your family, but from others. If you're taking ores and you're taking money, and then you're a professional builder, as far as I'm concerned.
So you don't necessarily subscribe to Malcolm Gladwell's 10,000. You got to do something 10,000 times to get it right.
Well, I'm a redneck. I don't know who Malcolm Gladwell is, but.
Mr. Outlier. He wrote a book called Outliers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No. I know about that book.
Yeah. So you're not
the
such a redneck.
The whole thing about Bill Gates' mom having running the computer and all that. Yeah.
Well, and that's, yeah, the being in the right place at the right time is sort of what that's all about. But
I
just wondered if maybe being a professional also had to do with, you know, actually building a specific number of frames or more than two or three that you're building, you know, whatever.
Well, I think there's probably 50 shades of professional if you want to do it that way. It's, you know, custom frame builders, most of them don't sell lots of bikes. You know, if a custom builder, a professional full-time custom builder is doing 50 bikes a year, you know, depending on the level of service and what he's offering, then that's probably a lot. So doing something 10,000 times, building 10,000 frames or filing 10,000 dropouts or whatever is going to take, might be a career.
Might be a couple of lifetimes, actually.
Yeah. It could take quite
That's
a while.
True.
I mean, there's a lot of frame builders out there who are much more prolific. But I think, you get, here's the way I like to put it. You get a guy who's been doing it for 35 years, and he's got the same 1 year of experience 35 times over. You know, and then you got a guy who's been doing it for a few years, but he has, you know, a talent for it. And his 50th frame may be better than somebody else's 500th frame. I think it's all about the individual. You know, not to take words from Lance Armstrong, but maybe it's not really about the bike. I mean, it's building bike frames is, it's part science, part craft, part art. Some guys have the full package, some guys don't.
I like that explanation. I think I like that a lot. So you also make a distinction between a fixture and a jig.
Yeah, I do.
Wait, you don't seem happy.
Well, you can blame that on my dad. My dad always said that jigs were made by carpenters.
Okay.
That's not to disparage any carpenters who might be listening. My dad was a lifelong machinist, and I learned a lot of what I know from him. And he was just very pointed on the fact that a machinist used a fixture and a carpenter used a jig. And You know, it's really semantics, and I understand that, but we call them fixtures anyway.
And that's, you can put the word professional in front of that, and it looks a little different from the wooden jig that some people make at home.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not where I was going with that.
Okay.
But no, I get your point. Yeah. No,
okay.
I mean, it's, you know, a fixture is used to locate things very precisely. And when I said it's semantics between fixtures and jigs, because the definitions of what those two things are cross quite often. But yeah, we call them fixtures.
Okay.
And we call them fixtures because that's what my dad told me to call them.
Okay. It's not a bad reason. It's not a bad reason.
Yeah,
so
no.
Let's go back to frame building itself for a second. In an interview you gave for Mountain Flyer magazine, you stated that you had the perfect skill set for frame building, only to find out that it was incredibly more difficult. What was so daunting about it?
Well, it is. A lot of people think, you know, it's sticking, you know, X number of tubes together. And it's not. It, you know, basically a bicycle frame is a stress-skin structure, and you're working I should start over. Here's the deal. The deal is that people have, and frame builders are largely responsible for this, but people have an unrealistic expectation of how precise a frame should be built. And I think that when you first get into building frames, that you really want to try to meet all those numbers and those little goalposts that other people have set or claim to have set. And so you'll often see, you know, you'll often see references to, you know, perfectly aligned frames, you know, zero tolerance, you know, with a line to X amount of thousands of inches. And that's fine, but it's mostly BS.
Okay.
And so, and so what happens is, like I was saying, is that you have this unrealistic expectation of how precisely a frame could be or should be built. And being a machinist, I understand that that's, like I said, mostly BS. It's just not that achievable. And if you do achieve it, it won't stay that way for long. And so when you first start out building, you have this idea that it's going to be a very simple matter of putting some tubes together. You're kind of going to hold them in these places, and when you're done, it's going to be, you know, a perfect bicycle frame. And that's not the case at all. And what happens is that once you start sticking these tubes together, what seems to be a very simple process becomes very complex, because you're actually working in, you know, a 4D environment. You know, a 3D environment, you know, X, Y, and Z, plus you have a fourth dimension of time. And so the less time you have to get it together, the harder and harder and harder it is. And so what you'll see is, when people build their first few frames, even if they've had professional instruction, it takes them forever, you know, on the relative time scale. And then when you have done it, maybe back to your 10,000th time, you know, in Outliers, you know, there are frame builders who can go out there to the shop, custom builders, with a drawing in hand, and I'm probably letting all these secrets out, but they go out to the shop and the drawing in hand, and, you know, and a tube set on the bench, and an hour later they have a frame that's assembled.
Interesting. Very
so,
interesting.
But, you know, a new guy coming into it might take him a month, and it is, when you first do it, very complex, and I think it's a little intimidating, because you have to have all these tubes have to have the same, the correct spatial relationships. And that's just the part about getting the tubes together. Then you have to consider about, you know, all the constraints or requirements that the components you're going to use place on you. Tire clearance, you know, derailleur placement, chainring clearance, fork crown clearance, you know, where brazons go on if you're doing racks, like for a random A-bike. I mean, it just gets more and more and more complex. And by and large, frame builders are grossly underpaid.
Well, that I can attest to, A.
Yeah.
And B, I think that those are some very interesting points that have not been brought up in other interviews we've done about the placement of the components. Because I think that today's production manufacturer is forgetting about a lot of those things too, you know, and not allowing for more clearance for brakes or more or better tolerance for chainring differences from 53 to 50 or whatever it is.
Yeah. I mean, a road bike construction is fairly straightforward, you know, for your classic road racing bike.
Right.
You know, you want difficult, build a 29-inch mountain bike with suspension.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, I don't want difficult,
you know,
but
you're
okay.
You're trying to cram all this stuff in the, you know, the same space that's occupied by other stuff. Building a road bike, a road racing road bike, is, you know, extremely straightforward, comparatively speaking. But that doesn't mean that it's easy.
Right.
And because bicycles are simple, people expect them to be easy. But simple and easy aren't the same thing.
So at one point, you were building some frames. You went to Interbike to show off your frames, and everybody was interested in the tools. And I had to laugh because I certainly get how that could happen. So how do you feel about the resurgence of all these handmade frames, the NABS, you know, sort of phenomenon that Don Walker started, what, 9, 10 years ago? And, you know, did you finally abandon building frames altogether?
Man, you're combining a lot into one
Okay, cut it up any way you see fit, but give me 1 second to let me remind our listeners we're talking with Don Ferris in Golden, Colorado, and Don is the proprietor of Anvil Bike Works. Okay, go.
Okay, yeah. What was the question again?
No, oh, I don't know.
Yeah, it's true. It wasn't actually Interbike, I don't think, that I took the – it was a different show.
Okay.
But I used to go to Interbike, but I took my frames. I was very proud. I had my tools that I had made as a backdrop, and then I had my frames mounted in frame fixtures, and I had various components mounted in various other fixtures that I had made, and at that show, they might as well have been my frames might as well have been made out of glass. You know, everybody was coming up and saying, "Hey, man, where'd you get those tools?" and I was kind of blown away by that. And actually, I had a friend of mine, Todd Schusterman, who owns Da Vinci Designs, and
yep.
he was kind of prescient with that because he said, you know, when he saw my stuff and he helped me a lot when I very first got started, he was saying, you know, what you ought to do is build tools. And I was like, yeah, you know, I'll never sell one of these things.
Yeah, right.
And I ended up selling all my stuff at that show.
Right, exactly. And had to go home and make more.
Yeah. And it just kind of went on from there. It was, looking back on it now, I was just very, very lucky. I mean, there's really no other way to describe it. I was just very, very lucky. I was in the right place and the right time. I wasn't trying to do it. It just happened. And it kind of fell in my lap. And so it wasn't long after that. I mean, it was just a few years. Well, not a few years. I mean, it was 2004 that finally I had to give up building frames. And that was a very difficult thing to do because the tooling just took over. And I had, by that time, by 2004, I had invested enough into the tools that I needed to make the tools that I just had to make the transition.
Well,
it was a very tough thing to do. It took a long time to come to that conclusion, but I was basically just pissing off all of my customers. I couldn't deliver tools on time. I couldn't deliver frames on time. I just had too much on my plate.
So there are some very nice photographic sets on your Flickr site, which people can find also on your website, which we'll tell them at the end of our conversation, that show these incredibly beautiful tools. Now, I work in a bike shop. I've worked in a bike shop for the last 38 years. I understand tools. I had a Campy toolkit, all that stuff. But this stuff is like jewelry. It's beautiful.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah.
How many different fixtures and tools are you offering to builders now?
A lot.
That's a good answer.
Yeah. I'm a frustrated frame builder. No, you know, if you look at the Renaissance, which you were speaking to earlier of frame building, and not only in the United States but all over the world, actually, the quality and the level of frames that's being produced today by the handmade builders is astounding. I mean, it's kind of jaw dropping when you look at some of the work that these guys are doing. It's It's just amazing. And so I don't do that. I don't get to do that. You know, I get to make tools. And so tools are my job. And when I started off making tools for others, I just made the decision and I had the drive to that I wanted to make tools that anybody would be proud to own. You know, they had to work right. They had to look good. You know, that, and tools say a lot about the builder. And, you know, if you go into your garage to a mechanic for your car and he's got, you know, cheapy Fred tools laying all over the garage floor and whatever, you know, you immediately make an assumption. You judge that person based on that. And when you go into the mechanic and he's got the, you know, the big snap-on roll around and blah, 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 you know, you're thinking, okay, this guy's really got an investment in his craft. And I kind of see it that way myself. And I've had lots and lots of customers who tell me that that a lot of times the tooling, when the customers come into their shop and see the tooling, they're like, man, you're the man.
And you know what? That makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of the selling that goes on just by looking around. So
completely true. Yeah.
All right. I want to know what metrology is. Did I say it right?
Yeah.
Okay. Talk about metrology.
No, metrology is measuring stuff. Basically, it is when it's normally used. You're talking about precision measurements. You know, making very, very accurate, repeatable measurements.
Okay.
And so and metrology is a big deal in a machine shop. Most machine shops. Because it's easy to say, well, that thing's good within a thousandth of an inch. And then you look around their shop, and they don't have anything that will actually measure a thousandth of an inch. You know,
okay.
I mean, it's just one of those deals, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say that. I didn't know that. I figured if they're saying so, well, they have to be able to prove it. Guess not, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And if you don't have the tools, then you can't do it. And generally, you know, you chase, what we talk about here in our shop is, you know, we're chasing decimal points. And it's called the ghost in the machine. You know, you're chasing a ghost when it comes to dimensions because basically you get far enough to the right side of that decimal point and you come to, the crux of what you can actually measure with, accuracy and preciseness, which, not really the same things, but you know, how fine you can actually measure. So let's say the height gauge that we use, the Tessa height gauge that we use on our surface plate, resolves down to the millionths. So it'll read down to millionths of an inch.
Who can see
Nobody
millionths
can.
Of an
inch?
Okay.
Can. Yeah,
okay.
You can't see it. And okay. So, but the machine is telling you, but the machine is lying to you. Because even though the machine will resolve down to millionths, it can't accurately and repeatably measure down to the millionths. It has to be able to resolve down the millionths to be able to accurately and repeatedly measure a 10,000th of an inch.
Uh-huh.
And so we measure, you know, to the fourth decimal place over there, four digits over from the decimal place, 1/10,000th of an inch. And that's what we measure for. And we do that knowing that if we can measure to the tenth, we can claim to the thousandths.
Okay.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. No, I totally
so
see what you mean.
If you go 10 times beyond what you're trying to get,
right,
you don't really know if that thousandth is there or not.
Is accurate. Sure.
It kind of goes back to my talking earlier about alignment on bicycle frames where you know, Joe Bob Builder will say, you know, my frames are aligned, perfectly aligned, you know, giving you the impression that it's, if you were to measure the theoretical center line and all the critical points on that frame, it would be zero from one end to the other. And, you know, you're talking a frame is 36, 40 inches, some odd long across the diagonal, you know, even on a road bike.
Right.
And it's basically a stress skin structure, so it's a series of very, very thin tubes joined together. And it ain't happening. You just can't do it. I mean, and if you do, it's luck. And it won't stay there anyways. You know, if you have a window open and the sun shines in on one side of the frame is going to twist, you know, to that direction. And so it's just what is what's achievable for alignment on a frame. And I think a lot of people think custom frames when they think perfectly aligned. And And that's not really the case. When they think custom frames, they should think, you know, handmade, handcrafted, relationship with a builder, you know, great care taken, you know, to make a unique product for a customer. But I see it all the time. I see guys claiming they can do this or that with their frames, and the reality is, you know, if they can hold a half a millimeter, they're really good.
Wow, I really appreciate that explanation. It was dead on,
Thank you.
Makes so much sense to me. So I'm just going to move on a little bit. How has NABS changed your business? Has it? Or is that just one more thing on the pile?
Yeah. Well, I think NABS has changed the business for the custom builder more than it has the custom builder supplier.
Okay.
I think as a service to the custom builder, the bespoke builder, you know, anybody who takes an order before they make the frame, I think it's done them great service. It's probably the single greatest thing that's ever happened to them, to bring them out into the limelight and place them on a more equal footing with, you know, the brand names that have, you know, television ads and full-page spreads and periodicals and whatnot. It's phenomenal. Don Walker, you know, should have a bust of him casting golds in somewhere. You know, there's a lot of people involved with the development of NABS, but Don was the guy that made it happen. And
right.
So, you know, no matter what else Don does for the rest of his life, he's going to have that little box is going to be checked for him. And
that's good.
And he's done great things for people.
So you mentioned Jill, and I saw the word Antarctica somewhere.
Yeah.
What's the relationship there? What's the connection?
With Jill and Antarctica, or with Antarctica, Jill and I?
Yeah, sure. Go for it.
Well, I met Jill in Antarctica, of all places.
Yeah, that's what I thought I read.
Yeah, I know, it's crazy, right? I had to go to the very ends of the earth to find somebody who'd marry me. Yeah, I know, it's crazy.
All right, what were you doing there? What was she doing there? And just tell me the short version.
Well, before I became Anvil Bike Works tool builder to the stars, I worked in the United States Antarctic Program.
Nice.
And I went down there. My first year on the ice was 1990, and I worked there until I started Anvil, which was in about 1998. And Jill also worked down there, and we met my first year down there, and we hated each other.
Of course.
I was in charge of a project out on an island, Black Island, and we were actually at that time building the communications center for McMurdo Station, and Jill was in charge of the Berg Field Center, the BFC as it was called, and so I needed things from her, and she needed things from me, and we never wanted to give them to each other. And then, and that was the first time we met. And then, after that, it was, I don't really know how to describe it, how it really happened, but, we became fast friends. And then we became more than that. And then we got married in 1997, and it's been wedded bliss ever since.
I got it. That's great.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, who would have thought you literally go to the ends of the earth and meet the person you're going to marry?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Yeah, it is crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. So the last thing I really want to talk about has nothing to do with bikes or frame building or fixturing or tools. It has to do with music.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a there was a comment at the end of that Mountain Flyer interview to talk about your music. So what's so special about Don Ferris's music choices?
I don't think there's anything really special. I'm kind of you know, when I'm old.
Oh, yeah, right.
Well, I'm 50.
But
my music tastes have never matured. I still listen to all the same music my kids listen to. Actually, I turn them on all the good stuff. They usually don't get the good stuff. But no, you know, we listen to music in the shop every day. And I mean every day. It's blaring. You can't listen to the radio. You know, you have to listen to music from, because you just don't want to hear the same commercials, you know, for
right.
for an 8, 10, 12-hour shift. And so, you know, I make up playlists and stuff, and I have a huge selection of music to choose from, and everybody who comes over loves our stuff. I don't know.
So what did you turn your kids on to? Like who?
Now you're going to put me on the spot.
Yeah, I am.
I hope my kids aren't listening because they're going to call me a liar. But some of them I probably shouldn't even say that I turned my kids on to because some people would think it's inappropriate. But
I won't. I probably did the same thing.
They're 26 and 21 now, so I think the statute of limitations has gone by.
Yeah.
But no, I mean, all kinds of stuff. Left Lane Cruiser, Power Solo, there's just a ton of, and not to be a hipster about it, but there's just a ton of music out there that's played by people, you know, that never get on the radio. They're like the custom builders of the music world, and they all have their fans and cults and whatnot. We play a lot of rockabilly. We play a lot of old country in the shop, you know, George Jones, Johnny Cash, any of that kind of stuff. If it's authentic, I guess is one way to put it.
All right.
We listen to all kinds of crazy stuff, stuff we probably shouldn't be listening to. We listen to rap, we listen to punk, and it's just a constant, stream. But we only play with my iPod, and that's one of the privileges of being a boss.
Yeah, it's only what's on my iPod, not on yours.
Yeah, I don't want to fall asleep when I'm in front of the mill.
No, good idea. I like that.
Oh no, not your iPod, but I'm talking about one of my guys.
Oh, okay. Well, you know what? This was so much fun, and Brian told me this was going to be fun. He has a lot of respect for you and what you do, and so do I. So thanks for talking to me. We will see each other at NABS in Denver in 2013, and I hope you have a great rest of the summer.
I hope I do, too.
Thank you.
And I hope you do, and thanks a lot for having me on, Diane. I really appreciate it.
It was my pleasure. Have a good night.
You, too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Don Ferris joined us from Golden, Colorado and Anvil Bike Works.
Yeah.
I like the way he thinks.
Yeah. Well.
It meshes nicely with a lot of things that Richard Sachs has to say.
Yes.
About how you can never achieve perfection, but imperfection is often
perfection.
Good enough.
Yes.
Yeah. Perfect enough for frame building.
Perfect enough for frame building.
Yeah.
Right. Well, we haven't found the perfect cyclist yet. We're still searching.
You're hurt.
Her out.
I'm hurt, Diane.
Could
I'm
be
really
her.
Hurt.
Could be a her.
No, I'm hurt.
Aw. You want to see the world's smallest violin playing Hearts and Flowers, honey? I'm sorry.
I thought that was me. Well,
yeah.
Anyway.
Okay,
so when
maybe
we find
when
we find the perfect cyclist, then we'll need the perfect frame.
Exactly.
Until then,
imperfection
is good
perfection.
Enough. Okay.
Okay.
Well, I think this show has been about perfect.
It's been very good.
Close enough
Close
for radio.
Enough. Yes, exactly.
And we'll see if we can equal or improve on it next week at this same time.
We will be here.
With another edition of The Outspoken Cyclist. Until then, ride safely and stay cool.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Lees. We'll be back next Saturday evening from 5:30 to 6:30 here on WJCU 88.7 FM and streaming live on the internet at WJCU.org. Don't forget, this show is available as a downloadable podcast also at WJCU.org, and we're on Facebook at The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.